Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hello there, this is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And maybe what America needs right now in the era of new terror threats and ISIS is a tough White House customer.
No, I would like to finish my point here.
I didn't know there was a point.
You asked me whether or not it warned of attacks.
I asked you what the title was.
You said, did it not warn of attacks? It did not warn of attacks inside the United States.
Condoleezza Rice publicly defending her role in the Bush administration's handling of the 9/11 attacks years ago. Okay, maybe we don't want to go back to the days of the old 9/11 commission and the Bush administration fiascos in Iraq and Afghanistan. More about all that in a moment, but go with me here. Maybe what the troubled NFL needs right now is someone like battle-tested and former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, who is used to the crisis hot seat and maybe has more management smarts than NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, whose legacy is starting to look dubious beyond the lucrative placing of beer ads and where to put Nike logos on NFL jerseys.
We have been very open and honest, and I have also. We didn't get this right. That's my responsibility, and I'm accountable for that.
There's Roger Goodell a week ago admitting mistakes in his handling of the Ray Rice domestic violence affair. One more thing. Condoleezza Rice is a massive sports fan and long ago said she would love the NFL job. But we begin this hour with a discussion of terrorism threats of today. Department of Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson testified today before the House Homeland Security Committee on the greatest perceived threats to our national security right now.
ISIL is obviously the most prominent terrorist organization on the world stage right now. It's our focus, but from my homeland security perspective, and I'm sure my colleagues share this, we have to stay focused on a range of terrorist threats.
Our next guest has written that unlike during the Bush era, today's threats have many more sources and may require many different kinds of responses. Gary Samore is executive director of the Harvard University Belfer Center, formerly President Obama's coordinator for weapons of mass destruction, counterterrorism, and arms control. Welcome.
Thank you, John.
So it seems to me right now that the Obama administration is in a kind of a contradictory set of circumstances. There's the attempt to review the Snowden revelations and government surveillance there. There's now a renewed interest in addressing the terrorism threat from ISIS. Are all of these competing interests and worries compatible?
Well, since the end of the Cold War, when the U.S. doesn't face a single unified national security threat, the presidents have had to deal with an array of threats, including ones that pop up unexpectedly. Snowden's a good example. Even the rise of ISIS was unexpected. No one anticipated they would be able to capture Mosul, and that obviously has raised their profile on the president's agenda. So, you know, as powerful as the president is, in many ways, his agenda is dictated by circumstances, by events beyond his control, often beyond his perception of what's going to happen, and he has to respond to those.
Is there any discussion in your experience in the White House that, you know, one approach to terrorism is to just de-emphasize its threat capability? Certainly it's scary, but its fundamental threat and the likelihood that any individual American would be caught in a terrorist attack is extremely low compared to, you know, what went on during the Cold War.
Well, I think after the 9/11 attacks, which was, of course, a huge shock to the American system, I don't think it would be responsible for the president to downplay the possibility of additional attacks of that nature. Now, you're certainly correct that both President Bush and President Obama have been extremely successful in terms of preventing any further major attacks, although there have been a number of smaller attacks. But I think as long as there are groups out there with aspirations for carrying out massive casualty attacks against the United States and are seeking to acquire nuclear or other weapons, the president has a fundamental obligation to defend the homeland, and that requires that we sometimes have to be aggressive in going after those groups, even in foreign countries.
So more than 13 years after 9/11, as the Homeland Security Secretary testifies before the House, what do you see as the principal challenges and his responsibilities at this point?
Well, we've been talking about the threat from non-state actors, which are primarily extremist groups that claim to act in the name of Islam. And al-Qaeda obviously was the first manifestation of that. There have been many other manifestations, including al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, now Islamic State. I suspect that this will be a generational threat, that for a long time the U.S. and its allies will face violent groups who claim to act in the name of Islam. So that'll be an enduring challenge that the U.S. will face. And whatever diplomatic and, you know, military means we can use to contain or limit the threat, ultimately the solution to that really has to rest within the Muslim community. And that's not something we can very directly affect. The second sort of set of issues which will be enduring are continuing conflicts and tensions with other countries. We have a rising China, which I think fortunately the prospects for managing that competition over the next decade or so without conflict are pretty good, but that requires a lot of diplomacy and work. We now have a resurgent Russia, and hopefully we'll be able to find a political solution to the Ukraine crisis. We have the threat of nuclear proliferation from countries like Iran and North Korea, which is tremendously important, especially because it would threaten our allies in the Middle East and East Asia. And then there's a long sort of laundry list of non-traditional threats, which the president can't avoid, everything from, you know, from disease to natural disaster to the environment to questions of, you know, humanitarian intervention. So as I said, unlike the Cold War, where there was a single unifying threat in the form of the Soviet Union, the president now faces a, you know, real kaleidoscope of different challenges, and some of them cropping up, you know, unexpectedly, as we've seen with ISIL.
One of the things we haven't heard much about, and I wonder if you could assess it, is the notion of the threat of a dirty bomb or a nuclear weapon. Has that diminished in 13 years?
Well, when President Obama came to office, he recognized or believed that the threat of terrorist groups acquiring nuclear weapons was a very significant threat. And one of the signature efforts of his administration has been to organize nuclear security summits every 2 years in order to strengthen international efforts to secure nuclear materials. And there have been three summits so far, and the last one for his presidency scheduled for 2016. I think those summits have been tremendously successful in terms of reducing the risk of nuclear terrorism by strengthening security of those nuclear materials. But I hope that the next president will continue that process, because unfortunately you can't rest on your laurels. You have to continually make efforts to monitor the security of nuclear material and facilities and strengthen them. But I would say since the end of the Cold War, where there was great concern about loose nuclear materials in the former Soviet Union, I would say all the presidents have put attention on the nuclear security issue, and I judge that the risk of nuclear terrorism has been reduced. But at the same time, there's a lot of nuclear material in the world that could be used for a dirty bomb or nuclear weapons, and there are still groups out there that would aspire to acquire and use it. So that's one of those threats that won't go away and has to be managed.
Well, on a guardedly optimistic note there, Gary Seymour, executive director of Harvard University's Belfer Center, formerly President Obama's coordinator for weapons of mass destruction, counterterrorism, and arms control, I want to thank you.
Thank you, John.
As Congress and the Department of Homeland Security discuss what constitutes a danger to the United States, we can see that the whole legal context of national defense may have radically changed in America to the point that we might be entering a real constitutional crisis. Here's just one telltale fact. A new Pew Research Center poll finds that half of Americans are concerned that the government's anti-terrorism policies, such as surveillance and police power, haven't gone far enough to protect the country, while only 35% of us worry that these policies have encroached on our civil liberties at all, and that's down from 47% last year. We turn now to Mark Tushnet, who's author of The New Constitutional Order and professor at Harvard Law School. Professor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So do you think this is a constitutional crisis in a sense that we don't really know what constitutes privacy and civil liberties anymore?
No, I'm not inclined to think that. I think what's happening is that the American people are learning sort of new information about the nature of the threats to our own national security, and then taking that new information and thinking about what kinds of notions of privacy and the like seem appropriate to us.
Do you feel as though the Edward Snowden revelations coupled with the barbaric ISIS beheadings may have desensitized people to some of the more subtle questions of what constitutes privacy and government intrusion?
Actually, my inclination is to think that those two things sort of work in opposite directions. The Snowden revelations led us to understand how actually extensive the degree of intrusion and oversight by the government was. The beheadings lead us to think that we should accept somewhat more intrusive surveillance than we might have beforehand.
Do you think that these Pew Research poll numbers might be an invitation to Congress to revisit the issues in the Patriot Act, which was hurriedly passed after September 11th, 2001?
It seems to me that Congress should revisit those issues, mostly because the statute was passed, as you say, quite quickly, and it took quite a while for the American public to understand what Congress had authorized. The Snowden revelations helped us understand that, and now I think we could have a more informed discussion about what the possibilities are and how the technology works, the technology of surveillance works, so that we could assess what kind of surveillance we want to have and what kinds we think are too intrusive.
You know, and that raises an issue that our listeners often bring up on this program whenever we focus on this issue of privacy and the Snowden-like NSA surveillance. You know, a lot of people tell us that, you know, look, I have nothing to hide and I don't care if the government watches me. It's not a problem. I'd rather be protected. Do you think there's a way of having a notion of appropriate surveillance that doesn't violate the Constitution that would allow people to basically be under scrutiny of the government without it being a question of, you know, constitutional, you know, violation of search and seizure, that sort of thing, free assembly?
I think, yes, it clearly is possible to have such a system. Just the most obvious kinds of examples, video cameras in public places, which are now quite common, I don't think raise any serious constitutional questions as a general matter. For me, I think the most troubling phenomenon is that technological developments are occurring so rapidly that it's very difficult for ordinary people to even know what's possible, much less know what the government's actually doing. And I think as a general matter, the government is going to push as far as it can in order to gain as much information as it can. And a lot of that will occur, at least for a while, without people really knowing what's going on.
The concerns of Mark Tushnet, who's author of The New Constitutional Order and professor at Harvard Law School, on the issue of privacy and policy regarding terrorism in the Middle East. Professor, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Here's a big story. The sponsors are starting to speak to the NFL, and their multi-billion dollar voices may be louder than the crowds at the Super Bowl. The Minnesota Vikings reversed course at about 2 a.m. Eastern time today. How terrified are they, right? And announced that star running back and accused child abuser Adrian Peterson will be now banned from all team activities, is indefinitely suspended. Anheuser-Busch said it is not happy with NFL handling of the Ray Rice and Peterson affairs. Imagine a beer company is the new moral authority on parenting and domestic violence. Also, shoemaker Nike has pulled Adrian Peterson jerseys from its stores in the Minneapolis area. Talking about the Minneapolis area and local reaction to all of this, Tim Nelson is a staff reporter at Minnesota Public Radio covering the Vikings for the Stadium Watch blog. Tim, welcome.
Hi, John.
Big, big story. What's the reaction there among fans and other sports watchers?
Well, I think people were a little surprised when the Vikings came out on Monday. General Manager Rick Spielman came out and announced that after deactivating Adrian Peterson on Friday, losing to the New England Patriots on Sunday, that they were bringing him back and he would resume practice and playing with the team. It provoked quite a strong reaction here. Our We're the headquarters for Radisson Hotels. They're a marquee sponsor for the team, and within hours they said they were suspending their sponsorship relationship. That's where things sort of started there. The next day, Governor Mark Dayton, who has been a big supporter of the team and a big supporter of building them a new stadium, came out and described the situation as a public embarrassment to the Vikings organization and to the whole state. At this point, even our junior U.S. senator and his Republican opponent on the ballot this fall have weighed in and said that the Vikings were wrong about this.
So pressure coming from politicians, from sponsors locally. What about pressure from NFL brass? Is there any there? Or even just the vast audience for the Minnesota Vikings, fans there on the street?
Well, fans, we went out and talked to them on Sunday, and they were concerned about this. Nobody really knew how this was going to play out, and obviously Adrian wasn't playing and the team lost. But I think people were sensitive to the issues that the team was facing here. It's hard to know. We've had a lot of dealings with the NFL as we've built a new billion-dollar stadium here. It's actually under construction as we speak. And, suddenly the Vikings said that they had this thing, this exempt commissioner's permission list that they could put Mr. Peterson on and not play him. So there seems to have been some interaction with them, but they are, as you know, a very secretive organization. They don't talk a lot about their internal workings or their internal finances. Obviously, they have an eye on the bottom line, though.
Yeah, well, that may change. Just in terms of local culture there in Minneapolis, I mean, you know, we're used to thinking of the kids there as above average, not beaten with sticks. I mean, this is going to go on for a while.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. This team routinely gets giant ratings here for its games. The Vikings consistently rank in the top 10 on web hits of all the NFL teams. There's a huge fan base here. Minnesota loves the Vikings and follows it with great interest. This has dominated the news here now for 5 days, and we're going to be following that as we go along here.
As a sports analyst, do you think the Viking fans are starstruck in the sense that Adrian Peterson is such a star? Does that drive the fandom, or is it just about the team itself and its long history?
Well, there's no question that the Vikings have made Mr. Peterson the face of the franchise. You know, when they released the renderings for their new billion-dollar stadium, there's a big marquee billboard on one end of it, and they put his picture up there.
Wow.
For years, when we have seen the new stadium, his picture has been on the front of it. He was the league MVP in 2012. I mean, he is, without question, the face of that franchise, which makes all of these decisions all the more agonizing as they go forward.
Tim Nelson, staff reporter at Minnesota Public Radio, covering the Minnesota Vikings for the Stadium Watch blog. Thanks, Tim.
You're welcome.
So we're talking to you now. With the Roger Goodell under pressure to resign, who is best placed to lead the NFL? New leadership? We're looking for someone who has previously described the position as her dream job. Some fans want Secretary of State, former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Cast your vote at thetakeaway.org. Would you support a move to have Condi Rice as new commissioner of the NFL? Love to know your thoughts. We're also trying to get your read on this issue. Which is it, folks, paper or plasma? In a moment, we'll have the next installment of the Takeaway Book Club. But what do you read? A bound book with the smell of glue and ink, or a glassy electronic display with sharp colors and a battery status at the top of the screen? From Grand Prairie, Texas, paper all the way. There is nothing like holding a book. The smell, the feel, it just takes you away. I do both, personally, just like my pal Robert here.
Hi, this is Robert from Salt Lake City, Utah. I read both digitally and on paper. The more time I want to spend with a book, and certainly the more likely I am to revisit it and reread it, the more I want to do that on paper. But digitally, there's some different, sometimes unique things that can be done that I couldn't do on paper. I can read faster digitally. Any notes or highlights that I make, I can search. But the experience itself, I find, is just simply more joyful on paper.
Huh. Does the brain approach digital reading differently than old-fashioned words on a page? An issue kind of raised there by our smart friend from Salt Lake City, Utah, Robert. Manoush Zomorodi, managing editor and host of New Tech City, is with us to help put all of this in context. Welcome, Manoush.
Hi, John. Great to be back.
Does the brain have a preference? I know you have a preference, right? Screens for you, right?
Well, no, just because it's New Tech City is my show, that doesn't mean that I prefer screens. Like, I've been thinking about this a lot, though, John, mm-hmm. because I did feel like something was happening in my head and I wasn't sure what it was. And then I ended up talking to Mike Rosenwald. He's a reporter with The Washington Post, right. and he has done a lot of research on this. And he found, like I did, that when he sat down to read a book, his brain was jumping around on the page. He was skimming. He couldn't just settle down. He was treating a book like he was treating his Twitter feed. And so linear reading, he discovered, which is something that we humans have developed over years and years, is what we need to do when we want to do deep reading, like immerse ourselves in a novel or read a mortgage document, God forbid. Dense text that we really want to understand requires deep reading, and the internet, we don't do that.
Well, Mike suspected that his focus was being degraded by his use of electronic devices. And Marianne Wolf, who's the director of the Center for Reading and Language Research at Tufts University, has also thought about this and maybe has some reassuring words.
I don't worry that we will become dumb because of the internet, but I worry that we will not use our most preciously acquired deep reading processes because we're just given too much stimulation. That's, I think, the nub of the problem.
So it's a matter of atrophy of existing capability, not necessarily a transformation of the brain.
Yeah, and when I talked to Dr. Wolf, she explained something so interesting. Neuroscientists now know that we use different parts of our brain depending on whether we are reading on a screen or reading on paper. They call it a biliterate brain. And the problem is that many of us have adapted to reading online just too well. And if you don't use the deep reading part of your brain, you lose the deep reading part of your brain. So Marianne says she has found a way to do this. Every night she commits a certain amount of time to reading on paper, because she sat down one day to read her favorite book by Hermann Hesse, not an easy text, The Glass Bead.
She's a real chucklehead.
Yeah,
Marianne,
she's real fun.
This, yeah.
And she couldn't do it, though. And, you know, this is her bag, right? She better be able to read a book.
Well, she's in her 50s, I believe. I don't think I'm betraying anything there. What about kids? I mean, there's a child development issue here. Here's Marianne Wolf talking about whether the brain is actually evolving to handle both of these channels equally well.
I think the evidence someday will be able to show us that what we're after is a discerning biliterate brain. But that's going to take some wisdom on our part. And it's also going to take people like you, Manoush, and I being almost like canaries and saying, pause, society. Think about what you are doing, you as adults and you as teachers of the next generation.
Yeah, to say nothing of that next generation. That's going to be a challenge.
Yeah, completely. John, I have to ask, you have a gaggle of children at home. Do you let them read on screens, or are they have to have paper?
Out of my five, I have four strong readers. My son is a little distracted, and I think it does relate to the fact that he is a gamer and he loves to be on screen, but he's also exercised his reading muscles, and I think he's benefiting exactly in the way that Marianne Wolf is talking about. He's getting better as a reader.
I've decided for my 7-year-old, no reading on screens.
Yeah, good luck with that. Let's talk about that in a segment on the program.
But John, I love this idea of pause, society, pause. And I think that that is really what we're saying here with reading and with so many things with technology is like, okay, before just doing it without thinking about it, think about the consequences, listen to what the options are, and make sure you give yourself a balance of both. It sounds a little self-helpy, but I think it's important.
Just you say that again, all right, Manoush? All right, just before we go.
Pause, society, pause.
Wow, you should go into politics. Manoush Zamarodi, managing editor and host of New Tech City on Reading on Screen or Reading on Plasma. What's your preference? Manoush, thanks so much.
Thanks. Great to be here, John.
Shakespeare's King Lear loosely inspired the latest takeaway book club book, The Lobster Kings, by Alexei Zentner, a family tale about the King's clan from Loosewood Island, Maine, descended from a pioneer and famous painter, Brumfitt Kings, who settled the island 300 years ago. Ancient traditions and small-town life are familiar territory for the members of the middle-of-the-book book club. Here's Carol Turrentine.
I get the daily records for crime. Generally, what I'm sending out to our neighborhood watch, those people who want to be on it, and it's a pretty extensive list, is for lost and found dogs or pigs, horses or donkeys that get out of
cows.
Their pens,
cattle.
Cows, yeah. So we do live in a very bucolic, safe, very community, civic-minded farming community.
Carol, Linda O'Leary, and Jonathan Kern of Middlebrook, Virginia, say they don't often encounter the turmoil and wild adventures on the pages of the Lobster Kings in their own town, like the chilling family curse which claimed the life of Cordelia's brother, Scotty. But they talked for us about the characters in the book as though they were folks they might have run into down at the general store.
I did not like Cordelia from page one. I found that she was a very selfish individual, and I was really liked her father, Woody. I didn't have much empathy for what Cordelia was going through until the middle of the book. Then it just there was just this rush of all these different events that were happening that were truly tragic. Just what was happening to this family, it was mimicking what was happening in Brumfitt's paintings. And I thought those paintings were created 300 years ago, and here we are in contemporary times, and it's like there's still this tragedy going on. So that part about King Lear, that part was certainly a parallel to the King Lear story, loosely based.
So, Carol, on the question of character, do you think Alexei Zentner is struggling a little bit to have a main character be a woman? He's speaking, you know, through the eyes of a woman, and it sounds like you didn't necessarily find her credible in some way.
I didn't. I just thought she made some really bad choices that, like I said, were very selfish on her behalf, not thinking about other people. I mean, look at what happened to Scotty, and look what her dad said. She was one of the ones that was responsible for what happened to him, and I'm not going to say what, because so the readers can read it and find out for themselves. But she just didn't seem to learn from her mistakes until later in the book. And it was really when her father was going through his health issues. And even during that time, it took a while, but then she finally, like, I think, got it. That, you know, she had to be responsible, and she just did not seem like a responsible person to me. And for someone who she felt that she should be the it of the king's legacy, I didn't think she deserved it until the end of the book.
Yeah, I agree with Carol. I didn't like Cordelia at the beginning. She thought simply because she was there and born that she was going to inherit this legacy. She seemed to be jealous of her sisters and her brother.
You know, in that sense, one of the things that surprised me is, you know, Cordelia is so sure she's going to inherit. And in King Lear, Cordelia is the least sure. Cordelia is the sweetheart who just sort of loves Dad in the end and, you know, is grateful to inherit but didn't believe it was going to happen from the beginning. And that's a little bit at odds with the Lear story. Jonathan?
And that was one of the sort of strands that Linda and I both were mentioning, I think, earlier to me on this. I didn't go reread all of King Lear after getting through this, but did refresh myself on the whole plot. And so it was a literary device that I thought was just a bit stretched. If you did want to use the King Lear and the Cordelia, then structure the story a tiny bit closer to the plot. Either have made the two sisters not necessarily evil, but more, it was Cordelia who imagined that her sisters were proactively trying to sabotage the relationship with the father or whatever. So, yeah, I thought that was one example of a little bit of the stretch of trying to bring something into the novel that either didn't necessarily need to be there, but once you had, I would have rather you'd amplified it more or used it more than it was.
Anyone expecting this to be a modern interpretation of King Lear would be very, very disappointed. And if you read the cover of the book, the back cover even mentions the King Lear reference, and so you're expecting something that's really not there.
Yeah, Woody is not a lunatic, that's for sure. He's actually very sympathetic.
It wasn't even fading powers. I mean, at the point... Okay, so the scene where he comes back from the hospital and he divides up the family, the quote family fortune, so to speak. And Cordelia gets nothing because she doesn't ask for anything, because she doesn't have anyone to ask anything for. I suppose, but that's hardly in the same lines as Goneril and the others with their fake protestations of love to King Lear and Cordelia's, you know, blunt honesty, and so she gets nothing kind of thing. And so, yeah, I agree with Linda there. I wasn't expecting a retelling of King Lear, but it was sort of, well, if you're going to use this plot device or literary device, then go right forward, use it.
Oh, I thought Woody was very fair to all of the children, really, especially the three girls. And, you know, it was in the end that Cordelia really got the best gift of all. She ended up getting the future, you know, the past and the future, if you know what I mean, with the descriptions of that particular painting at the end of the book. And what there were, how many other paintings in that box? There were a lot.
25
And those are, yeah. And I have a feeling she's going to hold on to those for the future. Those aren't going anywhere.
And that's really the family legacy, is this mm-hmm. founder of the island lobster business is a painter. And he, you know, in many ways, the story is told through these paintings, which I was really skeptical of because I can't see the paintings. And him describing paintings sounded to me like something that was going to be very annoying. But it actually was quite beautiful. There's one particular painting
yes.
where it's the painting of the grandson dying, you know, having drowned
yeah.
and caught in the nets.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just a page and a half, but whoa.
Yeah, you could almost see it happening. Yeah, it was really something. But that's the whole thing about the future and what happened to Scotty. And, of course, what happened to Scotty happened pretty early on, and then it was, you know, you're going, well, okay, so what's going to happen? What's going to happen next? And then it just kept happening.
Yeah.
Everybody kept, I mean, that family lost so many people in their own generation, but they gained a lot. I mean, I think they gained an understanding of each other. Sounds like with Cordelia's leadership, it will remain a lobster-king family.
Thanks to Carol Turrentine, Linda O'Leary, and Jonathan Kern, members of the Middle of the Book Book Club. Read along with us at thetakeaway.org/bookclub to find all our books in our series. Tell us your reading preference, book or ebook. And from Portland, Oregon, only paper books for the kids because I don't trust them with an expensive internet-enabled machine. Nothing against digital books. I do love my Kindle. Northern New Jersey says, I only read paper. It's so much more intimate. Reading on a screen is cold. Don't really feel the emotions within the story.
Hi, this is Mickey Curry from Astoga Park. I have a Kindle. I fought it for some time, but now I find it much more convenient. I do miss the feel of a paperback, but I never really liked hardcovers.
Thanks, Mickey. And Gonzalez, Florida, dodged the whole question. Tells us, I listen to audiobooks. We're fine with that. Technology and your changing reading habits. Tell us all about it, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or send us a tweet, @TheTakeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.